The political landscape is about to change in Washington and in Augusta. This is Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz. Those changes will involve the legislative branch in both places, the executive branch in Augusta. I talked about the changes with State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler and Chief Political Correspondent Mal Leary. Let's go ahead and start today with the new Congress, which will convene in January. It'll be a Democratic House, a slightly more Republican Senate. My first question is, what is that going to mean for Maine's Susan Collins?
I think what you've got going is that Senator Collins will continue to play her kind of broker role as a moderate member of the caucus, a dwindling number of moderate Republican senators, I will add. But nonetheless, there has to be working across the aisle to get anything done. And working across the aisle not only means working across the aisle within each chamber, but across to the other chamber. And because of her reputation as a moderate, dealing with Democrats on a lot of different issues, I think her role is going to be pretty much the same as it has been. Maybe a little less crucial because they no longer are just a 51-49 vote. They got a little bit of more latitude. But the reality is, in the Senate, most of the big pieces of legislation need 60 votes to go anywhere. The reality is, that means you're going to have Democrats and Republicans to get to that 60 figure.
You know, before the last couple of years, at least, she's been sort of this key swing vote potentially. While that role will probably be diminished going forward, I don't think the pressure on her is going to be at all. We just had Sarah Gideon, who's the Speaker of the House here in Maine, write an op-ed in the Bangor Daily News that essentially wanted to remind everybody about Susan Collins' vote on the tax legislation that the GOP passed last year and its inevitable effect on the Affordable Care Act. Now, that op-ed I saw as a marker by Sarah Gideon, basically saying, A, that she's serious about potentially challenging Susan Collins in 2020, and also that Democrats are going to keep the pressure on her. They see her votes on the tax bill, the health care component of that, and Brett Kavanaugh, who's now on the Supreme Court, as potentially fatal decisions by Susan Collins. And I expect that Democrats are going to be taking an X-ray to every move that she makes over the next couple of years. While her vote may not matter as much in terms of what happens in Congress, what she decides to do and the votes that she takes will matter in terms of her reelection hopes in 2020.
Now, Mal, you mentioned, of course, that big pieces of legislation in the Senate need 60 votes to get past potential filibusters. But, Steve, you pointed out the issues that were raised by the president's judicial selection of Brett Kavanaugh. There will be more judicial selections. There are now 53 votes in the Senate, so perhaps she has a little more room the next 2 years to back away from other potential controversial judicial appointments, and I think also some budgetary measures, too, that would only require a majority in the Senate.
You're right, Erwin. I think while her votes may not be as consequential, they will be closely watched, and I think that's the important distinction to make. While she may not be the person who puts a judicial nominee, a controversial one, over the top, Democrats are going to be watching those votes anyway because it's a reminder of the votes that were consequential this year and the previous year, too.
Do we have any idea what kind of legislation she would like to see emerge from this Congress on a bipartisan basis, or perhaps thinks is possible?
What we're talking about of the politics of her reelection is different from the politics of getting legislation through. I think you're still going to see her working closely with Angus King in the Senate and, quite frankly, with Shelley Pingree in the House of Representatives. The two of them serve on their respective appropriations committees and will continue to serve on their respective appropriations committees. Those are the two most powerful committees in Congress that decide how money is spent. And in the course of all of the dysfunction in Washington, we forget 75% of the funding for the federal budget has already been approved and is law. This threatening of a partial shutdown of the federal government only affects about 25% of the spending, half a dozen agencies or so. So while it is important and does affect a number of federal workers, it's far less than the sort of thing we've seen in the past years. They actually were successful in getting some of the biggest of the appropriations bills, like defense, through. I suspect that will continue to go on. They will work at the congressional level, for the benefit of the state and the benefit of funding. At the same time, people are playing the political games to try to set up for 2020.
Both Senators Collins and King also step up in Senate seniority in the new Congress. Is that going to make any significant changes in any of their committee assignments?
They do move up in seniority. For example, Collins may get a different subcommittee in appropriations than she has now. All of that is yet to be decided.
On another topic, I have here for you gentlemen a parting shot from Governor LePage.
I would have never reappointed Joe Jobb, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. He lied, and I just can't. I'm going to take that to my grave. Michaela Murphy, I wouldn't have reappointed her either, because she lied as well. A slightly different scenario. She had promised me she wouldn't do any more activism on the bench, and the morning, 9 o'clock after the election night, she had Janet Mills running around her chamber, and I thought that was disgusting.
Gentlemen, I've been in the state 40 years. I never remember hearing a governor criticize a judge by name.
Well, I have, Irwin. You forget that we did have a judge who was not reappointed because he had kept a person in jail over the weekend in violation of a state law. So there has been some criticism, but nowhere near as broad and blunt as this criticism. We're talking a Superior Court justice and a Supreme Court justice. He started criticizing Justice Jabber earlier in the year.
There's a couple of things at work here. I mean, Michaela Murphy, of course, is the Superior Court judge who has presided over a lot of the cases that LePage has launched, the Medicaid expansion issue, his refusal to implement that law. Michaela Murphy presided over that case. The closing of the Downey's correctional facility. Michaela Murphy was the judge in that case. Those decisions have not gone his way. And so that, of course, explains why he's targeting her by name. And it's also worth mentioning that these judges can't fight back. They can't hit back at Governor LePage. It would not be judicial to do that. So he's kind of lobbing some haymakers at two judges who don't have any way of responding, especially in the Jabber case. LePage claimed in a letter, you know, a searing letter, that Jabber had promised that he would retire so that LePage could appoint another judge, a judge of his choosing, to the Supreme Court, and that Jabber had reneged on that promise. It's also worth noting that attacks on the judiciary seem to be in vogue these days. If you look to the President of the United States, he's talking about Obama judges, Trump judges. This is it seems to be the new normal, which is really something, because it used to be we would not want to politicize the judiciary, but it clearly is going that way.
And I would point out that the criticism by Trump led to the extraordinary statement coming from Chief Justice Roberts of the U.S. Supreme Court, saying there are no such things as Trump judges and Obama judges and Clinton judges. They are just judges.
Yeah. One of the other things he's been doing is defending his very hard line on legislation, saying that half measures simply would not have worked. And Steve, I know you're working on a retrospective of the governor that will be airing soon. Are other people in agreement with that idea that LePage had to push as hard as he did in order to kind of steer the ship of state?
I don't know that people will necessarily agree. You know, even his supporters have been sort of reluctant to say that that was the appropriate tactic to use. I mean, he vetoed over 640 bills, which is the most of all governors combined going back before the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And that's 1917, okay? So what he did was extraordinary. And let's not forget how that pile of vetoes mounted. Go back to the 2015 budget battle, where he did not get the tax reform proposal that he so desperately wanted, which would have eventually eliminated the main income tax. So what he did when he didn't get his way was to threaten and actually carry out vetoing every single bill that was sponsored by a Democrat. Now, he did mostly carry out that promise, but he would have actually had more if he had vetoed some of the bills on time. There were about 30 bills, maybe more than that, that he did not send to the legislature on time. And that ended up in the Maine Supreme Court, which basically said, sorry, Governor, you were too late. One way to avoid vetoing bills is to collaborate. That seems to be the biggest criticism of LePage, is that he while he did achieve a lot, he could have achieved more if he had been a greater collaborator.
And by the way, it's not just the vetoes, but the other thing, of course, that I think LePage will be remembered for is the vituperativeness of his veto messages.
First of all, that's a great word. You're right. It's so true. I mean, these things were amazing. Mal, you'll remember this one. This is great. Was it the budget bill where he had all the pictures of drug dealers and everything else because he didn't get the law enforcement cash that he wanted?
He didn't get the law enforcement money that he felt was needed to enforce the drug laws. So he just went off on the legislature being soft on crime and spent as much time attacking Republicans as Democrats, which is something we have to remember.
He treated them the same as Democrats in some ways, Republican dissidents, that is. And if you go back to the 2015 budget battle, which resulted in so many of these vetoes, the result of that was fascinating. Basically, the legislature became so balkanized, it was split into factions. It was Democrats in the House and Republicans in the Senate who would agree to work with one another. And then this other faction of LePage hardliners. And that balkanization in the legislature would help explain so much of the dysfunction that happened here over the last few years. Think of the government shutdown of 2017. I mean, if you can tell me what that battle was about, I challenge you to do so. At the end of the day, the budget that was signed and put into law was effectively a proposal that was ready to be voted on by the legislature back before the government shutdown back in June of that same year.
Yeah, so. I mean, the thing that struck me about it was that over time, especially on budget matters, the governor became kind of disconnected from the process. You know, with the exception of that one shutdown, the legislature did manage to keep coming up with budget bills and passing them with the needed two-thirds majority and then overriding his vetoes.
That's correct. The reality was when he engaged in legislation, it usually resulted in a bipartisan bill that passed and became law. But when you're talking about setting spending priorities, really with Paul LePage, it was my way. This is what I think is the proposal that needs to pass. This is the funding levels. All these other, you know, I'm just not going to negotiate with you people because this is what it should be. And when you have that kind of an attitude, you don't have one of the key players involved in negotiations.
The other thing that happened as a result of him withdrawing from the legislative process is the explosion in lawsuits that he was involved in. Issues like the Downey's Correctional Facility, which could have been resolved potentially if there was better communication between him and the legislative branch. I mean, that became a case that ended up in court. Maybe Medicaid expansion would have ended up there anyway. Also, the clean elections snafu that ended up in Superior Court as well. All of these things were legislative matters that could have been resolved if the executive branch and the legislative branch were communicating effectively with one another, but they didn't, and that's why they ended up in court.
Well, looking forward, we have late news into Political Pulse headquarters here. Governor-elect Janet Mills is going to nominate Bruce Van Note, longtime deputy commissioner with the Department of Transportation, to succeed David Bernhardt. At the State Transportation Department, I believe that gets the governor up to 4 nominees that she's announced so far, which does now put her perhaps a little bit ahead of where Paul LePage was at this time 8 years ago.
And I think that pace is going to continue. The governor-elect told me that she's trying to get as many of these done as possible before the inauguration. I'm suspecting we're going to see several more next week.
Mal Leary there, along with Steve Missler. Be listening for Steve's retrospective on the LePage years. It'll be airing soon on Maine Public Radio and will appear on mainepublic.org. We air abbreviated versions of this podcast, Maine's Political Pulse, Fridays on Morning Edition and on Weekend Edition. The podcast version of the conversation is available online at mainepublic.org/politicalpulse or wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer is Willis Ryder Arnold. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Back with you next week.